Happy Hump Day. It's Wednesday, January 8th. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. Coming up, details about the Minneapolis crime rate, a sale of the St. Paul Macy's store, another meeting about Southwest LRT, a deportation reprieve, and medical marijuana. First, after spending 9 months behind bars in the United Arab Emirates, a Minnesota man will be returning home soon. Laura Ewan reports.
A Minneapolis attorney working to free Shehzan Kasim says the 29-year-old is in a deportation center and getting ready to be released. Senator Amy Klobuchar advocated for Kasim's return to Minnesota and said she learned this week from the UAE ambassador about the decision to free him. Klobuchar says she's not concerned that the University of Minnesota grad is gaining his freedom by being deported.
At this point, when a guy's been in prison for doing nothing but putting a video up for 9 months, you don't really question if he should have been deported or not. You just want to bring him home, which was one of my points to the family. For now, no matter how we could get him out, we wanted to get him out, including deportation.
Kasim was jailed in April after creating a spoof video poking fun at Dubai youth, and he was sentenced last month to a year in prison. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota Republicans and Democrats will hold their 2014 state conventions in different cities, but on the same weekend. Here's Tim Pugmire.
The Republican Party of Minnesota announced that its state convention will be held at the Mayo Civic Center in Rochester on May 30th and 31st. The convention will include the endorsement of candidates for governor, U.S. senator, and state constitutional officers. State GOP Chairman Keith Downey said in a news release that the party is excited to bring delegates together in Rochester. What he didn't mention was that Minnesota Democrats will be gathering in Duluth on the same weekend. The DFL state convention had already been scheduled for May 30th through June 1st at the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center. The two parties traditionally schedule their conventions on different spring weekends. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Winona State University is offering early retirement to more than 250 employees. Alex Friedrich has more.
The university needs to trim about $1.5 million, or up to 2% of its spending. Campus officials say they have no plans for layoffs or program reductions. But faculty union leader Daryl Down says the administration may reallocate money among departments.
This is somewhat of a signal that there is likely to be some reorganization and reprioritization of programs on our campus.
Campus officials say enrollment remains high and that the move is preemptive. A recent dip in the number of freshmen taking classes this fall may signal a long-term demographic trend that could cut into revenues. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Reports of violent crime in Minneapolis in 2013 rose slightly over the numbers reported the year before. Police say they will intensify their focus on reducing robberies and shootings, which both went up. At the same time, homicides and rapes decreased. Brant Williams reports.
Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto presented a mix of good and bad news at a year-end crime review press conference held at a public library in northeast Minneapolis. Some violent crimes dipped between 2012 and 2013. Homicides dropped from 40 to 36. Reported rapes fell from 416 to 385. Nonviolent crimes like burglaries, which are break-ins, also dropped. Harto says some of the credit can be attributed to a policy she instituted last year, which encouraged officers to get out of their squads and meet with people one-on-one.
They've been on horseback, they've been out on bikes, and they've been in areas that we normally haven't seen that. They've been out in neighborhoods, and that's been incredibly important. So they've made new connections, new relationships. Why? Because people can talk to somebody who's not in a police car.
Harto says officer visibility has been particularly helpful in Dinkytown near the University of Minnesota campus. The campus and the surrounding area saw a rash of robberies and sexual assaults in 2013. Business owner Greg Pillsbury says officers patrolling the campus are doing a good job.
We have undercovers around. We have a lot of eyes on the street in Dinkytown. I mean, both the police, the owners like me, and then the residents. There's people watching. And when we need to call 911, we do. And when we call them, they show up.
Harto also stressed the importance of residents reaching out to police officers to help solve crimes. Lieutenant Bruce Jensen says in one case, police received a valuable tip from a resident after the department issued a crime alert about some burglaries in a northeast Minneapolis neighborhood.
And what do you know? We got a call from a citizen who saw that crime alert. and we wound up making an arrest on that because of that crime alert. That's what the whole thing started with.
Harto says juvenile violence also declined slightly in 2013. For that, she credits the outreach efforts of youth engagement workers employed by the city who regularly meet and talk with young people downtown. But in the bad news category, gun violence, particularly in North Minneapolis, went up. There was an uptick in shootings and robberies, and Harto says many of the robberies were committed with firearms or BB guns. She says guns are still too readily accessible to people who shouldn't have them, including gang members.
We did see some uptick in some of the gangs that certainly were settling scores this year, but nothing that was out of the norm.
The number of shootings, shots fired calls, and shot spotter detections recorded in North Minneapolis in 2013 dwarfed amounts reported in precincts that cover other parts of the city. Last year, more than 2,500 gunshot-related calls were recorded in the 4th Precinct. That's more than half of all gunshot-related calls reported citywide. Also, during that same period, officers in the 4th Precinct recovered more than 350 guns, more than half of all firearms placed into evidence by officers throughout the city. North Minneapolis resident Clinton Collins says he appreciates the hard work of officers working the north side, but says more cops will not solve some of the basic problems he sees in his neighborhood.
And I think the problem is that you have kids raising kids, and we're now in the third or fourth generation of kids raising kids. I mean, I really think that is the biggest piece.
Collins says too many young people are growing up in dysfunctional families and get started off in life on the wrong foot. He says the best short-term solution is to arrest and remove people who are disrupting the neighborhood.
And then once we get some of the worst out of our neighborhoods, then we need to address some of these other historical issues. But right now, there are some kids, what I dealt with this summer, they're just bad people for whatever reason. They are bad news, and they need to be away from me and my family.
Collins says he's directly confronted some of the young people selling drugs or causing trouble on his block. And once, one of them threw a brick through one of the windows of his house.
That's Brant Williams in Minneapolis. The St. Paul Port Authority plans to buy the vacant building that used to house the city's downtown Macy's store. The port says Macy's has accepted a $3 million offer for the building, which has been vacant since the store closed in March. If the Port Authority Board approves the sale, it will take ownership of the property at the end of the month. Curtis Gilbert talked about it with Tom Cran.
Why is the Port Authority buying this former department store?
Well, it gives the city of St. Paul control over what happens there. The mayor of St. Paul appoints the Port Authority Board. And the mayor's office, frankly, was worried that Macy's might sell to someone who would do something with that building that the city wouldn't like. Maybe just rent out a few parts of the property and leave the rest of it mostly vacant. And in fact, in a memo that was released last year, the city was openly worrying about whether maybe a Burlington Coat Factory type store might take the place of Macy's. They described that as the worst case scenario.
Now, what does the Port Authority plan to do with the building?
Well, they plan to put it right back on the market as soon as they buy it and try to sell to a developer who'll do something with the property that the city will like. Mayor Chris Coleman has said he'd like to see perhaps a high-end office space blossom where Macy's used to stand. The port itself is open to a wide variety of uses, residential, institutional, even healthcare. But it doesn't think one big store like Macy's is going to be able to use the 350,000 square feet of retail space that's there now.
Now, does this mean the city isn't letting the private market decide what happens to the property?
Well, what the Port Authority says is that Macy's was too anxious to unload the building and wasn't giving the private market enough time to deal with this. There were, in fact, private real estate investors who were considering, who were negotiating with Macy's, and one of those deals actually fell through fairly recently, and that's when the port decided to step in and essentially take control of this situation.
So where does the Port Authority get its money to do this?
Well, ultimately, that money comes from city property taxpayers in St. Paul. The port is a governmental entity. It borrows money to acquire property, and it has a tax levy, just like the city of St. Paul does, that ends up on your property tax bill if you own property in St. Paul.
Owning a big, vacant former department store like that isn't free. Obviously, there are costs. How much will it cost, for example, for the pipes to keep pipes from freezing this time of year for taxpayers?
Well, that's not entirely clear. There is, on the plus side, attached to that Macy's building, and part of this deal is a parking ramp, which is operating, which is creating revenue. Unfortunately, Port Authority says that's not going to be enough to cover all of what are called the holding costs of holding on to that building. So property tax payers are essentially going to be subsidizing that as well.
But I suppose this wouldn't be the first time that St. Paul taxpayers actually underwrote that building. Remind us of the situation formerly with Macy's.
Yes, well, in 2001, the city actually gave Macy's, or it was then Target Corporation, and that was when this was a Dayton store, a $6.3 million forgivable loan to do a big glitzy upgrade of the building's facade and other improvements. They actually, Target Corporation poured $20 million total into that building. It's interesting that today it sells for $3 million.
What about the building itself? It sounds like some of the plans might be for a different building, or are they going to demolish it or just develop it the way it is?
Well, right away, they're going to try to see if they can sell it to someone the way it is, but the Port Authority is not ruling out the possibility of knocking down that building some point down the road if they can't seem to interest the market in the property with the building standing there as it is today.
Curtis Gilbert, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Curtis Gilbert with news that the St. Paul Port Authority plans to buy the vacant building that used to be Macy's in downtown St. Paul.
And that was All Things Considered host Tom Cran. People who live near the planned Southwest Corridor light rail line had another opportunity to chime in about the project last night. The 16-mile line will connect downtown Minneapolis to Eden Prairie, but a major sticking point remains. How will the light rail tracks coexist, if at all, with the freight tracks, especially near Cedar Lake? Last fall, Governor Dayton put the project on hold so the Met Council could study alternatives. Results of the studies will be out in the next few weeks. Here's Matt Sepik.
The slender strip of land between Cedar Lake and Lake of the Isles, known as the Kenilworth Corridor, is too narrow to add light rail alongside the existing freight rail tracks and bike paths. Planners considered rerouting the freight through St. Louis Park, but two-story berms topped off with trains proved unpopular in that suburban community, so the Met Council gravitated toward another solution, keeping the freight where it is and putting the light rail in shallow tunnels. The shallow tunnel proposal, which does not have the Met Council's official approval, would cost $160 million and has raised concerns among residents about damage to the lakes. Several hundred of those residents stopped by a project open house at the Kenwood Community Center last night. Among them was Eric Larson. He said he supports public transit in general, but taxpayers should not have to cover the cost of moving the freight tracks or putting the light rail underground.
We're talking about spending $160 million just to support the railroad when they could easily be rerouting west of the Twin Cities and avoiding this section altogether.
Rerouting freight is something former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback and the new mayor, Betsy Hodges, have long supported. Hodges Policy Director Peter Wagenius says the freight rail study underway could determine the best way of doing that.
Up to now, the question has been, you know, how can we do this in a way that the railroads will love it, not what works? And if we answer the question, what works, and we get a good answer, the idea of rerouting the freight should very much be, you know, back on the table.
Metropolitan Council Chair Sue Haig says the study will be released in 3 to 4 weeks, and the public will have another opportunity to comment. Haig said in October that the shallow tunnel option would be best because it preserves green space and bike trails. But on NPR News The Daily Circuit yesterday, she said she's also open to putting the light rail trains at ground level.
I think the alignment of light rail in the Kenilworth Corridor is the right choice and the right alignment. And I think what we're going to learn from this study is there a different way to deal with the freight rail? Can it be, in fact, relocated out of this corridor in a safe and a productive manner?
Two other studies of the light rail project are also underway. One is looking at landscaping in the Kenilworth Corridor. Another is trying to figure out how the construction work will affect Cedar Lake, Lake of the Isles, and the channel between them. Another open house and public meeting on the estimated $1.5 billion Southwest Corridor project is set for tomorrow evening in St. Louis Park.
Matt Sepik on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Two southern Minnesota immigrants facing deportation to Mexico have gotten a reprieve. Federal immigration officials say a father and son can now stay for a while. Their case revolves around a medical issue, Mark Stile reports.
Last fall, federal immigration officials ordered the father, Simon Cruz Perez, and his son, Alejandro, to leave the U.S. by January 15th. Both had been found to be in the country illegally. The two had airplane tickets ready and were scheduled to fly to Mexico next Monday. But then officials with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, changed their minds and said both can stay. In letters announcing the decision, ICE did not explain why they reversed their position and have not responded to requests for comment. But the family was happy to get the news. The son, 24-year-old Alejandro Cruz Blanco, says he's relieved that the deportation order was canceled.
Oh, I feel wonderful. I'm very happy, and I feel like I can breathe now.
He says the reason he feels like he can breathe is because he has a serious kidney disease and worries what might happen to him if he's deported. 4 years ago, his father donated a kidney to him. Both are in good health now, but Cruz Blanco takes anti-rejection drugs and other medication every day because of the transplant. In an interview conducted before the ICE decision, Cruz Blanco says he doubts he could get adequate medical care in Mexico.
I gotta take my pills all my life and nowhere to go there in Mexico. If I get sick, it's gonna be worse.
His doctor is more blunt. In a letter of support, Tina Melanson, who practices medicine in eastern South Dakota, said sending Cruz Blanco back to Mexico meant certain death. She contacted medical officials in the region around Veracruz, Mexico, the home area for the father and son. She says based on the prevailing wages paid in that region and the cost of insurance, the two would not be able to pay out of pocket for the anti-rejection drugs the son needs.
One missed dose allows your body opportunity to recognize that kidney is foreign, and once that rejection starts, it is very hard to get it under control.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar was one of those who urged ICE to allow the father and son to stay. Klobuchar says she told the agency it needed to follow its own stated policies. She says a 2011 ICE memo spelled out specific factors which immigration agents should consider in deciding whether to deport an individual.
And it clearly says that circumstances of medical history and some kind of severe illness are a reason that someone's deportation can be deferred or other decisions made.
The senator also says the problems in the St. James case underscore the need for immigration law reform. The news of the deportation reprieve is something many residents of St. James were waiting for. The town has supported the father and son over the years as the two face disease and deportation. Pharmacist Paul Winchell was one of those active in the effort, which included fundraising. He says one of the major events residents staged was an enchilada feed.
We had a great involvement with all of our Caucasian and Hispanic people and rallied to his support, and we're noted for that in our community. We're a very helpful, generous community. When anybody needs help, we rally together.
In all, he says more than $10,000 have been raised for the two. Much of the money went for a down payment on the kidney transplant operation. More funds were raised recently for airplane tickets back to Mexico should they be needed. The announcement of the deportation stay means that the father and son can remain at least one more year in Minnesota. They hope eventually it will become permanent. ICE officials say the status of the two will be reviewed once a year.
Mark Stile there in Worthington. There will be a renewed effort in the coming state legislative session to legalize medical marijuana in Minnesota. Governor Dayton has said he will only sign the legislation if it has the endorsement of law enforcement. So far, they have been opposed. This morning, Kathy Werzer spoke with Heather Ozzie with Minnesotans for Compassionate Care, a group pushing for legalization of medical marijuana.
Now, the FDA has not tested or approved marijuana as a medicine. Where are the studies that show marijuana makes for an effective treatment for those with terminal conditions?
The science is clear. Marijuana is safe and effective treatment for a variety of debilitating medical conditions. Countless researchers and organizations have documented the medical benefits of marijuana, including the Institute of Medicine, the American College of Physicians, the American Public Health Association, the American Nurses Association. If medicine should be based on science and not politics, our laws should reflect the facts and allow doctors to recommend marijuana to patients if they believe it will be effective.
The FDA, though, has not tested or approved marijuana as a medicine.
That's correct. The FDA has approved several studies to look into the therapeutic value of marijuana. Unfortunately, the National Institute of Drug Abuse controls the only legal supply for medical marijuana in the entire country, and it requires the DEA to approve them to release that marijuana to the researchers. They've blocked it.
As you draft a bill, will you set restrictions on which illnesses will be covered by medical marijuana?
Oh, of course. Our bill is very carefully crafted to provide the ability for doctors to recommend this medication only to patients that have specific medical conditions that research has shown this is an effective treatment for.
Give me an example.
Cancer, AIDS, seizures. We do include pain. Neuropathic pain is notoriously hard to treat, and marijuana is a very effective medication for this.
So if I have a bad back, if I'm in constant pain, I could get medical marijuana under your bill?
That's a conversation that you will have to have with your physician. Here in Minnesota, we give the ability to determine what medication is the most effective treatment for a particular patient to that doctor. The Medical Licensing Board supervises that process. It'll be exactly the same here. You're not going to be able to walk into any doctor and walk out with an ID card that will allow you to purchase marijuana. This is nothing like California or some of those early medical marijuana states.
But you mentioned California. It is pretty easy for recreational users to get a prescription, and you're confident in Minnesota that would not happen.
I am. Yeah, we've learned lessons now. 20 states plus the District of Columbia now have medical marijuana laws on the books. We've had decades to learn how to do this right. And we get to learn from every single one of these laws.
Heather, if you label marijuana medicine, is there the perception of this substance that is harmless? Could that lead to increased use of it by young people?
You know, there does not appear to be a link between the passage of medical marijuana laws and increases in teen marijuana use. And in some cases, it appears to be associated with decreases in teen use. A 2012 study conducted by researchers at universities in Colorado, Montana, and Oregon found no statistical evidence that legalization increases the probability of teen use, and noted that the data often showed a negative relationship between legalization and teen marijuana use. State surveys of students in several states with medical marijuana laws have consistently reported declines in teen marijuana use since those laws were passed.
As I mentioned in my introduction, this is an issue that has come up several times in the Minnesota legislature, but law enforcement has been a potent lobbying force against it. Governor says he'll sign a bill that can be worked out by your group and law enforcement, but it's been tough at this point. How are you going to convince law enforcement leaders to support your legislation?
I'm actually not sure that we do need to earn law enforcement support of medical marijuana. Asking law enforcement to support marijuana is kind of like asking firefighters to support fireworks. It's not really a fair question. I believe that Governor Dayton is looking at this a little differently. He's looking at law enforcement to fulfill their role in helping us to prevent abuse on this law. But we're looking at doctors to determine when and if marijuana should be medically available.
Heather Ozzie, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. There will be some devilry afoot in downtown Minneapolis this weekend as the Opera Stars of Tomorrow present Griffelkin at the Lab Theater. The fully-fledged opera about a devil being sent to Earth is being mounted by a cast all under the age of 18. UNCARE reports the performers are being held to professional expectations.
The cast members lining up at rehearsal in the Lab Theater brim with antsy teenage energy. Then, as the music starts, they open their mouths and produce a very grown-up sound.
Believe it or not, it's a little intimidating.
Daniel Ellis, resident stage director for the Minnesota Opera, must corral the 73 cast members in Griffelkin. It's a job he clearly relishes.
These are so extraordinarily talented kids. We're doing what is essentially a 20th century adult opera.
Ellis says NBC Television commissioned Lucas Foss to write Griffelkin in 1952 after scoring a success with Amahl and the Night Visitors, the first opera ever written for American TV. Griffelkin is the story of a young devil who is sent to Earth to wreak havoc for one day. He hurls himself into the task.
I was always too shy. I was shy, but I'm eager to try. My name on the sky.
Grifelkind finds life on Earth both confusing and attractive. When he befriends two human children, he enrages his masters in Hades, leading to unforeseen results. The Project Opera production of Grifelkind is double cast. There are two singers, Claire Walsh and Tori Adams, in the title role. They'll switch off during this weekend's four performances. Walsh, a sophomore at St. Paul Academy, and Adams, a junior at Edina High School, have been coming to Project Opera for several years. Claire Walsh originally auditioned just because she wanted to learn how to sing.
But then I learned about opera and appreciate it and have gotten really into it. So, yeah, it wasn't intentional.
When asked about their very adult-sounding voices, both Walsh and Adams admit it took a lot of practice and, Adams continues, building on small improvements to make a big change.
Suddenly you can sing a phrase that you couldn't before with, you know, you don't have to breathe in the middle, yeah. Or just like little things like that. It's just, you know, daily practice, which I will admit I don't do enough, but and listening to other singers.
Stage director Daniel Ellis can't say enough about the talents of his two main singers.
And for being as young as they are, and to be able to do a full two-hour opera, and as with most operas, you know, the last high notes are at the very end of the show, they've really learned how to pace themselves, sustain themselves.
And Ellis isn't afraid to hold his performers to high professional expectations. Both Adams and Walsh plan to study voice in college and want opera to remain in their lives in some way, maybe even as a career. The Minnesota Opera's community education director, Jamie Andrews, says producing the opera singers of tomorrow is part of Project Opera's mission. But it also welcomes young people who just want a quality classical music experience. Participants come weekly from St. Peter, Eau Claire, and Duluth. Andrews also believes the program is having an impact on the Minnesota Opera itself.
We're seeing the benefit from these kids now performing in our chorus, performing with other opera companies. And they're, you know, they're so connected and so passionate to the art form because they've actually touched it.
And Andrews says having young audiences hear their peers' huge voices will help develop the opera audiences of tomorrow too.
That's NPR arts reporter Ewan Kerr on the NPR News Update. Thank you for listening. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back with more Minnesota news tomorrow. Just